recommends abortions as soon as cardiac activity is detected, which can be as early as 6 weeks of pregnancy and at a time when most women do not know that they are pregnant. The law passed last year, but a judge blocked it from being enforced. The Iowa Supreme Court reiterated in June that there is no constitutional right to an abortion in the state and ordered the hold to be lifted. Iowa is among 24 states that have banned or limited access to abortion procedures since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
I'm Gifford Phillips, and I'm associate, formerly publisher of Frontier Magazine, and after the happy wedding that took place between our two publications last week, I'm now associate publisher of The Nation magazine. And before introducing the distinguished guests at the head table, I would like to introduce my colleague of some 20 years who is in the audience, former editor of Frontier Magazine, now associate editor of The Nation Magazine, Phil Kirby. Phil, will you stand for a minute, please? I'm going to introduce the guests of honor at the head table, and will you please hold your applause till the end. There seem to be some that are they're a peripatetic lot. They don't all seem to be here, but I'll introduce those who are. On my left, Ed Mosk, co-chairman of the conference. Next to him, Kerry McWilliams, editor of The Nation magazine. Please hold your applause. On my right, James Starrow, publisher of The Nation magazine. Next to him, a man who needs no introduction, Dr. Martin Luther King. Next to him, Robert Vaughn, co-chairman of the conference. And on his right, Mr. Jack Spitzer, participant in the conference. There was just a slight pause there, Jack, that was apparently meaningful. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to James Darrow.
Thank you, Gift. I can't begin to tell you all what an honor and a pleasure it's going to be to work with an associate like Gifford Phillips, and to have on our staff such a man as Phil Kirby as associate editor, something I look forward to. Now, I have some rather unfortunate and doleful news. We had hoped to have here Mayor Jerome Kavanaugh of Detroit, and circumstances conspired against his coming. He has sent the remarks which he would have made, and rather than make them myself, which would be only anticlimactic, I can assure you all they will appear in the published record of this conference. Now, one other thing about those remarks. They are the remarks of a mayor of a large city on the what is happening to the large cities of this country as a result of the war and as a result of the expenditures that are being made. Those remarks are concurred with, I think, by many, many of our large city mayors One in particular I know concurs with them is Mayor Naptalin of Minneapolis. Now I'll turn the meeting over to Mr. Vaughan.
Thank you, Mr. Storrow. It's a great honor to be a co-chairman of a meeting with so many distinguished visitors, and an even greater delight to see such a large crowd assembled here. It seems that we have representatives of all of the societal structure of the area, with the possible exception of Sam Yorty's travel agent, who is a little busy. But it's a great honor. Throughout the history of mankind, diversity has been viewed as an enemy, and self-satisfied men have forever feared change, even though the ultimate alternative to change has been extinction. Some so-called change has hardly been change at all, but simply the replacing of a familiar condition with another. While actual change, having like everything else of dimension two sides, can evolve the spirit of man or retard it. This reluctance to change is the fear of the unknown. Yet, if any change has ever been created in the human condition, it has occurred and evolved only at the rate in which man challenged those unknowns. To resist change is to refuse to evolve, while to seek change can be man's most heroic act. Intolerance can be likened to a fortress. Within the fortress lies status quo, consensus, and a limited comfort. Outside is exposure, vulnerability, and discovery. Outside is change. Now, to live within the fortress is to live with fear. To live without is to live with courage. Gifted men have long attempted to lay siege to that fortress of intolerance, or sometimes more subtly, have invited those within to come out and enjoy the pleasures and creativities of freedom. History records her unusual men. Of these, she honors but a few, the insightful few. Armed with the power of truth, moved by love, with the courage to brave man's archaic defenses in hopes of setting him free from his always debilitating fears. In other words, to change him. Not to take away from him what he is, but to give him more of what he might be. If Martin Luther King's strivings were to be evaluated, certainly among the most impressive would be that the means defines the ends, that the silence of good men is not peace, and that change must be wrought. Truth never damages a cause that is just. We are honored today with the presence of a man whose only armor has been truth, whose cause has been just, whose courage and dignity have elevated all of us. Edmund Burke remarked, "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." Racism is evil, and the history books will not record that Martin Luther King stood silent and did nothing while intolerance, inequality, and racism triumphed in this republic. Dr. King.
Mr. Storer, Mr. McWilliams, other distinguished platform guests, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this afternoon
And to have the privilege of being a part of this very significant conference. And in the very beginning, I want to express my deep personal appreciation to my friend Robert Vaughn for these very kind and gracious words of introduction. It's always good to be in California and to renew old friendships and fellowships, and I'm happy to share the platform with friends that I've known all along. I see Jack Tenner is here with us today, and he's been a great supporter of our work in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You know, he's a great fundraiser, and one evening, we were having a fundraising meeting at the home of Burt Lancaster, and when he got to making the appeal, my associate Ralph Abernathy said, "You sound like a good Baptist preacher." So whenever he talks to you about money, you better hold your pocketbook very closely. But we're happy to be here with all of these friends. And of course, whenever I come to California, particularly when I take the flight out of New York or Chicago, I'm always happy to get on the ground, because the flight over the Rockies, you know, is usually very turbulent. And after a turbulent flight, I am always happy to land. And I don't want to give anybody here the impression that I don't have faith in God in the air. It's simply that I've had more experience with him on the ground. Let me say briefly how happy I am to be here under the auspices of Nation Magazine. Through its journalistic integrity and its genuine liberalism, certainly this magazine has carved for itself an imperishable niche in the annals of journalistic history in our nation. And I know those of us who are readers and subscribers of Nation Magazine are deeply indebted to it for all that it has done to make the discussion of the vital issues of our day and our age a reality. I think we can all say, I'm sure Nation would appreciate that applause you're about to give. And certainly in these days of emotional tension, when the problems of the world are gigantic in extent and chaotic in detail, there is no greater need than for sober thinking, healthy debate, creative dissent, and enlightened discussion. And I think this is why this particular symposium is so important. And so this afternoon, I would like to speak to you candidly, and I hope forthrightly, about our present involvement in Vietnam. And I have chosen as a subject from which to speak the casualties of the war in Vietnam. We are certainly all aware of the nightmarish physical casualties of this war. We see them in our living rooms in all of their tragic dimensions on television screens. And we read about them on our subway and bus rides in daily newspaper accounts. We see the rice fields of a small Asian country being trampled at will and burned at whim. We see grief-stricken mothers with crying babies clutched tightly in their arms as they watch their little huts burst forth into flames. We see the fields and valleys of battle being painted with humankind's blood. We see the broken bodies left prostrate in countless fields. Most tragic of all is the casualty list among children. It is estimated that some 1 million Vietnamese children have been casualties of this brutal war. A war in which children are incinerated by napalm, in which American soldiers die in mounting numbers, while other American soldiers, according to press accounts, in unrestrained hatred shoot the wounded enemy as they lie on the ground. It is a war that mutilates the conscience. These casualties are enough to cause all men to rise up with righteous indignation and oppose the very nature of this evil war. But the physical casualties of the war in Vietnam are not alone the catastrophes. The casualties of principles and values are equally disastrous and injurious. If the casualties of principle are not healed, the physical casualties will continue to mount. One of the first casualties of the war in Vietnam was the Charter of the United Nations in taking armed action against the Viet Cong and North Vietnam. The United States clearly violated the UN Charter, which provides in Chapter 1, Article 2, that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. And in Chapter 7, it states that the Security Council shall determine the existence of any threat to peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, and shall make recommendations or shall decide what measures shall be taken to maintain or restore international peace and security. It is very obvious that our government blatantly violated its obligation under the Charter of the UN to submit to the Security Council its charge of aggression against North Vietnam. Instead, we unilaterally launched an all-out war on Asian soil. In the process, we have undermined the purpose of the UN and caused its effectiveness at many points to atrophy. We have also placed our nation in the position of being morally and politically isolated. Even the long-standing allies of America have adamantly refused to join our government in this ugly war. As Americans and lovers of democracy, we should carefully ponder the consequence of our nation's declining moral status in the world. The second casualty of the war in Vietnam is the principle of self-determination. By entering a war that is little more than a domestic civil war, America has ended up supporting a new form of colonialism covered up by certain niceties of complexity. Whether we realize it or not, our participation in the war in Vietnam is an ominous expression of our lack of sympathy for the oppressed, our paranoid anti-communism, our failure to feel the ache and anguish of the have-nots. It reveals our willingness to continue participation in neo-colonialist adventures. A brief look at the background and history of this war reveals with brutal clarity the ugliness of our policy. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945. After the combined French and Japanese occupation and before the Communist Revolution in China, they were led by the now well-known Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of her former colony. President Truman felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence. And we again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. With that tragic decision, we rejected a revolutionary government seeking self-determination, and a government that had been established not by China, for whom the Vietnamese people have no great love, but by clearly indigenous forces that included some communists. For 9 years following 1945, we denied the people of Vietnam the right of independence. For 9 years, we vigorously supported the French in their abortive effort to recolonize Vietnam. Before the end of the war, we were meeting 80% of the French war costs. Even before the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, they began to despair of their reckless action. But we did not. We encouraged them with our huge financial and military supplies to continue the war even after they had lost the will. And during this period, United States governmental officials began to brainwash the American public. John Foster Dulles assiduously sought to prove that Indochina was essential to our security against the Chinese communist peril. When a negotiated settlement of the war was reached in 1954 through the Geneva Accord, it was done against our will. After doing all that we could to sabotage the planning for the Geneva Accord, we finally refused to sign it. Soon after this, we helped install Premier Diem. We supported him in his betrayal of the Geneva Accord and his refusal to have the promised 1956 election. We watched with approval as he engaged in ruthless and bloody persecution of all opposition forces. When Diem's infamous actions finally led to the formation of the National Liberation Front, the American public was duped into believing that the civil rebellion was being waged by puppets from Hanoi. As Douglas Pike wrote, and horrid Americans helplessly watched Diem tear apart the fabric of Vietnamese society more effectively than the communists had ever been able to do. It was the most efficient act of his entire career. Since Diem's death, we have actively supported another dozen military dictatorships, all in the name of fighting for freedom. When it became evident that these regimes could not defeat the Viet Cong, we began steadily to increase our forces, calling them military advisors rather than soldiers. Today we are fighting an all-out war, undeclared by Congress. We have well over 300,000 American servicemen fighting in that benighted and unhappy country. American planes are bombing the territory of another country, and we are committing atrocities equal to any perpetrated by the Viet Cong. This is the third largest war in American history. All of this reveals that we are in an untenable position, morally and politically. We are left standing before the world glutted by our own barbarity. We are engaged in a war that seeks to turn the clock of history back and perpetuate white colonialism. And the greatest irony and tragedy of it all is that our nation, which initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world, is now cast in the mold of being an arch anti-revolutionary. A third casualty of the war in Vietnam is the Great Society. This confused war has played havoc with our domestic destinies. Despite feeble protestations to the contrary, the promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefields of Vietnam. The The pursuit of this widened war has narrowed domestic welfare programs, making the poor white and Negro bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home. And while the anti-poverty program is cautiously initiated, zealously supervised, and evaluated for immediate results, billions are liberally expended for this ill-considered war. The recently revealed misestimate of the war budget amounts to $10 billion for a single year. This error alone is more than five times the amount committed to anti-poverty programs. The security we profess to seek in foreign adventures, we will lose in our decaying cities. The bombs in Vietnam explode at home. They destroy the hopes and possibilities for a decent America. If we reversed investments and gave the armed forces the anti-poverty budget, the generals could be forgiven if they walked off the battlefield in disgust. Poverty... poverty... urban problems and social progress generally are ignored when the guns of war become a national obsession. When it is not our security that is at stake, but questionable and vague commitments to reactionary regimes, values disintegrate into foolish and adolescent slogans. It is estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. We have escalated the war in Vietnam and de-escalated the skirmish against poverty. It challenges the imagination to contemplate what lives we could transform if we were to cease killing. At this moment in history, it is irrefutable that our world prestige is pathetically frail. Our war policy excites pronounced contempt and aversion virtually everywhere, even when some national governments, for reasons of economic and diplomatic interest, do not condemn us. Their people, in surprising measure, have made clear they do not share the official policy. We are isolated in our false values in a world demanding social and economic justice. We must undergo a vigorous reordering of our national priorities. A fourth casualty of the war in Vietnam is the humility of our nation. Through rugged determination, scientific and technological progress and dazzling achievements, America has become the richest and most powerful nation in the world. We have built machines that think and instruments that peer into the unfathomable ranges of interstellar space. We have built gargantuan bridges to span the seas and gigantic buildings to kiss the skies. Through our airplanes and spaceships, we have dwarfed distance and placed time in chains. And through our submarines, we have penetrated oceanic depths. This year, our national gross product will reach the astounding figure of $780 billion. All of this is a staggering picture of our great power. But honesty impels me to admit that our power has often made us arrogant as a nation. We feel that our money can do anything. We arrogantly feel that we have everything to teach other nations and nothing to learn from them. We often arrogantly feel that we have some divine messianic mission to police the whole world. We are arrogant in not allowing young nations to go through the same growing pains, turbulence, and revolution that characterized our history. We are arrogant in our contention that we have some sacred mission to protect people from totalitarian rule.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
The following program is brought to you by the Pacifica Program Service and Radio Archive.
I have in the studio with me Paul Robeson, who needs no introduction, and Harold Winkler, who is president of Pacifica Foundation, which operates KPFA, as most of you know. Mr. Robeson has been known and loved as an artist all over the world for many years, but he has also, I believe, attracted considerable and worldwide attention in his role as a world citizen and as a person who was very deeply concerned about the society in which he lived. I wonder, Mr. Robeson, if we could kick off by asking, when did you first become involved in the political aspects of...
May I first say how happy I am and privileged to be with you here, and how deeply I thank this station for its kindness throughout the years. I've been on two or three others this time, but always have been I've had a welcome here, so I want to thank you. I would say, as I indicate in a recent book which is now out, it will be on the stands pretty soon, Here I Stand, Story of My Life as I Tell It, not too autobiographical. It began when I was a little boy in Princeton, New Jersey. Strange to say. Technically, this is the shaping of my views, a Negro boy born in Princeton, New Jersey, in a college town where the students mainly came from the Deep South. You know, Princeton and Princeton, Harvard, and Yale was the sort of the southern university of the North, whether you know that or not. And so I grew up in Jersey in a rather southern atmosphere. And my father was a minister, and I was shaped against that background. Technically, I entered the sort of the arena in the United States of fighting for social justice for my people in a concert, when I was in a concert in St. Louis in 1947, in the Post-Dispatch, where I was singing at the Kiel Auditorium, one of the big auditoriums there, and the NAACP asked me in St. Louis at that time to come on a picket line because Negro people could not even sit in the theater, which was just across the street. And so I grabbed a banner, and lo and behold, I saw Walter Houston coming down the street. He was in the play. So Walter walked out and joined the picket line, too. And a few nights later, when I was doing the concert, I said that I could not quite resolve the contradiction between singing to an audience in St. Louis, where there was no segregation, of course, but also the same people had not, to my mind, were not fighting to see that my people could sit in the theater. It's been corrected since. And so I said that I was giving up my career technically for the moment to enter the realm of the day-to-day struggle of the Negro people especially.
And this was your first political action?
That was within this context. This is very important to get in the context. My first actual, to come back to your question, was in London in 1933. It isn't very well known, which I clarify in the book, that I went to play Showboat in London in 1928. Jerry Kern was with me and Oscar Hammerstein, and we had a great success. And then I did concerts in 1928, and I became domiciled and lived in England, domiciled there, paid my taxes there, from 1928 until 1940, after the war began.
Does this mean, Mr. Robeson, that you spent most of your time in England during this period?
It meant that I came back now and then for concerts. I was here in Oakland many times, but I went back and spent most of my time in Great Britain.
It's perfectly
true. I was there in 1930, played Othello. So again, this is extremely important. At that time, I said, for the public to see, that I felt, I would explain it today in this light. We understand why many of my people have come to Oakland, to the vicinity, from Mississippi and from the South. There have been migrations into California, I understand today, from everywhere. But for many years, as you know, many of my people have left the South, because the conditions in the North were better, okay? I felt the pressure so much in 1928 that instead of stopping in New York, I just went on to London. Hmm. That clear.
And did you feel no pressure there in sense?
I felt nowhere near the pressure. Now, that does not mean that you haven't the background of the English colonies and so forth.
Yes,
but
I wonder.
But the pressure, but I say it's a difference between right here now and say, let's say, the Mississippi of Mr. Eastland. You understand?
Yes.
This is quite different. So America's quite different. There are great differences. So I found England that much more of a difference, that's all. Mm. I found Canada that way. When I was playing Othello some years ago, when we got to Toronto, the cast said to me after a week, well, Paul, why are you so different? The play is much deeper. You seem to be freer. I said, that's quite true. That's quite true. I'm in a country where there is no, this is not a question. I'm on a theater, on a stage with many other white actors. This is not a problem here. So obviously I feel freer. That's right. I'm in a different, but I don't feel the pressures that one would feel in the Deep South all the time, but it would interest you to know, and I've put it, that I feel any Negro, if you were honest, would have to say that even in our democracy as at present, that he is never any one second unconscious of the fact that he is a black American or a colored American. He can never be unconscious of it in any part of the United States.
Mr. Robeson, have you been back to England since the last war?
Oh, yes, I was back in 49.
The point I wanted to get at is that when I was in England last year, I became aware of the large number of West Indians who are now London, and I heard rather nasty overtones my talks with some Englishmen that frightened me.
No question
about a change that might take place in England.
No, again, if you want to go further into it, nothing could be worse than South Africa. And I'm only saying, I put these things down. What is most important is that at the height, having lived many years out and enjoying the height of success in Great Britain, that I decided that I must come back to my own country to struggle in this and to make the sacrifices that I have. That's the most important thing in this regard. And I am here.
Now, wait, would you spell this out again for me? You left England because England is not as attractive feel you have a greater mission in the United States?
No. Let's don't get into that. There are many places in the world where, personally, it would be much easier to live than in the United States for an American Negro.
In other words, your commitment is definitely to what you feel you can do
in
this country.
That's right. And Langston Hughes, in a book discussion before the book club in New York just a while ago, pointed out that every important Negro novelist, not only Richard Wright, but many others, that the great 95% of them live in Paris or somewhere else in the world. Mm. Why? Because the pressures, personally, are much simpler.
And yet, in the foreword of your book that I have before me, you quote Frederick Douglass as saying, a man is worked on by what he works on.
That's right.
He may carve out his circumstances, but his circumstances will carve him out as well.
That's right.
Is this part of the reason why you feel that you must be back in the United States?
I made the decision some years ago, and I say certainly that I spring essentially from here, like you threw the other day about the Indians in North Carolina. If you recall, that was in Robeson County.
Yes, I noticed that in the item.
Now, this is a very interesting thing which I point out in my book and which explains a good deal, too, of how I feel. Now, I was born on the edge of Robeson County, and my father is a Robeson and was a Robeson because he was a slave, my own father, a slave of the Scottish Robesons who still control Robeson County in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I approach these problems from a very close point. But I have a home, and my people are tobacco workers and sharecroppers today on plantations in that county. But a part of that soil belongs to me. That's my roots. These are my roots in this country. On the other hand, also, I felt that, somewhere, the contributions that I had, could make some contribution from my background traveling about the world. However, I never expected, I am quite willing to say, that I would be restricted from traveling.
Yes.
Well, tell me, Mr. Robeson, was your commitment to the political scene then largely as a result of your feeling about your own people, or our own people, let's put it?
Yeah.
Or did it have other overtones of conviction?
First it starts as an American Negro interested in my own people. The other great change is very constant in my mind. I was in the Welsh Valley, and the Welsh people sing very much like we do in the Negro people.
Yes, I've heard
many
them.
Of our songs, beautiful songs. And I was one of the few outsiders who has sung at a Welsh Eisteddfod, their national festival which has gone on since the time of the Druids. And I went down in the mines with the workers, and they explained to me that, Paul, you may be successful here in England, but your people suffer like ours. We are poor people, and you belong to us. You don't belong to the bigwigs here in this country. And so I today feel as much at home in the Welsh Valley as I would in my own Negro section, any city in the United States. And I just did a broadcast by translated cable to the Welsh Valley a few weeks ago. And here was the first understanding that the struggle of the Negro people, or of any people, cannot be by itself, that it is a human struggle. And so I was attracted then met many members of the Labour Party, and my politics embraced also the common struggle of all oppressed peoples, including especially the working masses, specifically the laboring people of all the world. And that defines my philosophy. It's a joining one of we are a working people, a laboring people, the Negro people. And there is a unity between our struggle and those of white workers. In the South, I've had white workers shake my hand and say, Paul, we're fighting for the same thing. And so this defines my attitude toward socialism and toward many other things in the world. I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership in the interest of all.
Is that a democratic socialism, or?
I would have to be a democratic socialism. There are many ways, however, to a struggle toward democracy, as I see that in a place like China, for example, today, the Soviet Union, many other places, or take our own problems of Negroes. If we were free in the South tomorrow to carry our weight, to vote into everything, would we now look around and try to find the 10 billionaires among our people? Would we attempt to build them up, or would we try to answer the needs of the great millions of our people? And so I see other ways of life, socialism, as trying to solve the problems of millions and tens of millions of peoples at once, in a way, instead of we would start from the individual to the masses, they start from the masses this way. Now, there are two ways, and there are difficulties each way. I have made the decision to join in a collective struggle, and the reason that my personal sacrifices mean very little in the struggle, in one way, when you see the children at Little Rock, what does not giving a few concerts mean, if you can make some other contribution? It's in that context. So nothing is perfect in the world. We're going toward it from different angles. I feel is a great burden of proof on every society, on our own as well today.
On our own as well. Mr. Robeson, some years ago, I was talking to a French member of the Communist Party.
Yes.
And in the course of our discussion, he said to me, you, Mr. Winkler, are a Jeffersonian Democrat.
Yes.
You can afford it in your rich land. Yes. But in my land and in other lands, we must give up our freedom now to certain men in order to achieve freedom for our children in the future. This is an act of faith for me, he said, mm-hmm. giving up my mm-hmm. freedom now. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself sympathetic with...
I don't think that is... I would put it quite differently. No, nor do I think that's any part of any socialist philosophy or communist philosophy, as far as I know, that we struck it during the war under Roosevelt, for example. We had to give up many privileges. They're practically telling us we have to do that again. I mean, in any sort of a war economy, in England, for example, they have not eaten eggs almost for years and years because of certain pressures. And it seems to me in the socialist lands, the Soviet Union, China, and many places, that's quite true. It's one thing to say today that they don't have as shining apparel as we do, but they have made tremendous scientific progress. And within one generation, so to speak, within 40 years, have become one of the most powerful countries in the world. Now, they've done it by great sacrifices, and not by, to my mind, they feel that the country, in one sense, the man in the street, may not in every essence belong to him, but he feels it's much more his than, say, I do in Charleston, South Carolina, when one Southern American Negro explained to me that I was in the state of our great plantations. I said, are you sure about that? Our great plantations. I don't feel that they're my plantations. But in one sense, some of the people in the socialist lands feel that the country does belong to them in a real sense. Now, there are, and as far as the basic concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat and so forth, I would say, again, bring it back to our own history. There was, as we know, a dictatorship of the North over the South in the days following the Civil War. When that dictatorship was removed, the colored people reverted practically into a kind of servitude. I could have conceived of a dictatorship over the South for quite a longer period, from my point of view, quite frankly. So this is understandable.
Yes. In your book, Mr. Robeson, Here I Stand, you have a chapter entitled The Power of Negro Action.
That's right.
What are some of the specific acts which you recommend, and perhaps in the order of priority?
Well, I say in any Negro life, you would say that nobody, this is, seems to be rather startling to many of my friends. Nobody would be startled, say, with taking the vote of the power of Italian action, or Polish action in Detroit, or Catholic action in New York, and so forth. I mean, that the vote would be a block, and the power of the Negro vote in the North in certain states. This is one very important aspect. Very clear. A kind of, we have tremendous economic power in this land today. There should be tremendous support of Negro business, of Negro banks and so forth, loan associations and so forth. But the prime thing is that I'm convinced that, yes.
Taking this last illustration of yours, have you not found that as Negro bankers become richer, that they grow away from your people?
No, I don't. I
or
know
do they remain a part of total Negro action?
There's no way for, as I said before, for any American Negro, however wealthy, however famous, to be anything at this period of our history at some point than an American Negro.
If he doesn't know, I can see.
If he doesn't know it, he'll find it out.
From a racial standpoint, Mr. Robeson, but from the political standpoint of socialism, which you were discussing a few moments ago, surely a Negro capitalist, if he had the opportunity, would undoubtedly behave according to the lights of his own.
He has to, but
business.
But I know many of the most wealthy, and they often I feel that they don't help as much as they should. But he's forever conscious his children suffer the same things as the poor Negro's children. And at some point, he finds a way to help. Mm-hmm. It's a little different even there. But that is
In other words, you feel it tracks through in a different way.
But I'm really not. What I'm trying to say is that somewhere for our own dignity, I see, that is Africa, would you understand, Ghana today, unifying as a, with its own sort of, nationalist strength. Is that clear?
Yes. Yeah.
I feel in America, strange to say, especially in the South, that even with all the goodwill of white liberals in the country, that it's very important for the Negro people to know what they want and to unify to do it. Often in a very simple case of fighting segregation, one group of Negroes can be drawn aside because of political pressure, other pressures. We should unify, too. We should unify.
Yes,
I feel there's got to be a unity in order to integrate. That's what I feel. I feel that we just can't integrate as individuals.
Yes. But isn't the example of Liberia, for example, a sorry example, as it said against Ghana?
Well, yes, because that's a very simple. The Firestone has taken care of that. It has been exploited to its hilt by Firestone rubber, if you don't know the facts.
Yes, right. It still remains, then,
right.
An economic
and
question.
And so has Ghana.
Rather than a racial unity question. It remains an economic question its fundamentals,
no,
rather
I think
than the
Ghana
unity of
also,
the Negro people.
Ghana has the unity of its own nation, same as Chinese or Indians, very close to India. India's just, they have a culture and a history that has its own national characteristics.
But what will prevent Ghana from becoming another Liberia?
That's the...
What do you mean?
Well, from because
Liberia today
pressures.
Is completely controlled by Firestone, not by Africans. But I feel that Nkrumah is going to control the economy of Ghana, and at some time be strong enough to say to the European, either you sit here and acknowledge that we run our own country, like Nehru, or else you go. But I don't see the day when Liberia can tell Firestone to do that. Oh, they're quite different. They're quite different. Liberia is a complete vassal state of American capital, finance capital, without question. They have nothing to say, nothing whatsoever.
What is your reaction to the passive resistance as practiced in Montgomery?
I think there was a magnificent movement, and nobody can, I say, there's nothing, as far as the general thing of a nonviolent solution of the problem, this is the, there could be no other solution within our, within the frame of things today. I mean, this is a very important contribution. Nobody could think of a violent solution unless somebody wanted to ask somebody to be destroyed. I mean, that would be absurd. On the other hand, within that framework, I think that the Negro people have to be extremely militant and demand a little more than they are demanding today, and to do a little more, to do other things as well as pray, let me put it, as well as pray.
Do you think there's been a change in the attitude of the Negro churches toward militant political and economic action, Mr. Rhodes?
I think there has, because it's history, you know. Take Frederick Douglass. I belong to the AME Zion Church. There's one in this area. And Douglass was a part of that church. Harriet Tubman, who formed the Underground Railroad, who was called the Moses of our people. They sang Go Down Moses when she came into the South to free the slaves. And Harriet Tubman. And we have a tradition of tremendous, consistent speaking out, you know, for our rights. Like in the whole civil rights struggle. I mean by militant, letting people know that you want to be free like anybody else. And I think the churches, however, a lot of the responsibility still rests upon our churches, because that's where so many of our people, you know, go. They have tremendous influence still.
Mr. Robeson, do you think your artistry as a singer and actor have suffered because of your involvement in political action, or profited?
They have not. I feel that they have profited. They've only suffered when they've suffered by the fact that because of my political views, which I certainly did not expect in a democracy, that I've been prevented from exercising my craft. However, I've kept singing all through the years. You may be able to test it pretty soon. I just made a recording the other day for Vanguard, which they felt was superior to any records I have ever made. My voice is still in fine shape. I've been in the area. And as far as Othello, I've worked on it. I feel I've just been invited to play at Stratford-on-Avon, the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre in England, in, strange to say, in Pericles, to play the part of Gower. And I would certainly do Othello at some point in London, and I feel I would give a better performance. I feel that in every, and I've got a lot of things here which we won't be able to get to in my music, comparing the folk music of the world, I would say that my interest in my art has deepened just no end in the last years. And I become interested in the music of Bartok, of Mussorgsky, many folk things, the unity of the folk music of the world, which has sprung from my political conviction that all people should be unified. I have seen it expressed in their music, and I do a program, which of all the songs of all the peoples in the world, suggesting that we are all one human family. It all comes to that. So I feel that basically that it has deepened my... On the other hand, I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being. I've always put it even more strongly that, to me, my art is always a weapon. It's got to be good art. Othello was a weapon in racial relations, or at least showing that we can do some things too. I played football. My father explained to me that, well, Othello hit me, I couldn't hit him back because they'd say we were bad and savage, so I had to stand and be knocked all around. I had to do well in my studies. So I've never been able to divorce one thing from the other. And luckily, I don't sing the kind of songs that you're here and you hit the high, whatever it is, the high B flat and the high this and the high that. I sing songs that express very much the emotions of different peoples, like the Welsh, the Scotch, the Negro, Chinese, Russian, and so forth.
Well, what is the present state of play on this passport business? You were talking about your British invitations.
Yes.
How are you going to get there?
Well, luckily, I think at this point, the basic case is before the Supreme Court. It's the case of Rockwell Kent, contending that all the cases revolve around, that when the State Department put in its administrative necessities that one sign a non-communist affidavit, whether or not he is, was, or so forth, that this is a violation of constitutional rights. Any American now has to sign this particular proposal. And this is before the Supreme Court. And in its present temper, it seems to me that the court might easily decide.
And this is what you refuse to do. You refuse to sign such a document.
Oh, yeah, completely refuse. This is a complete invitation. Did you murder your wife yesterday or the day before? Are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? This is but my political opinions are my own business, you know. This is a complete... And I say we have the background of the reversal in the Smith Act cases all over this country. So somebody was framed, I would say. So it shows that all of it, to my mind, is a complete hoax from somewhere.
In other words, you're hoping that on the basis of some of the current court decisions that you may get your passport in time to go to England.
Yes, or I have now been invited to sing on April 6th in a national television broadcast. Maybe I could get special permission to go. I mean, and because of my background in England, there is almost a national, almost demand from England, or request, that I be allowed to come in April and even before the summer.
Equal Portions is delighted to join Jazz and Justice Radio, WPFW, every Monday at 1 p.m. beginning August 5th. We're talking everything food justice, interviewing folks across all sectors, and playing the hottest new DMV music with your host, Sasha Lamira.
Hey, y'all. On Equal Portions, we'll be discussing all aspects of the way we interact with food, from the problems affecting our communities to the history and the story of the food around us and the local individuals within the food community. That's Equal Portions, Mondays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Alma Johnson Powell, the wife of the late Secretary of State Colin Powell, has died. Born in October of 1937, Mrs. Powell studied speech pathology and audiology at Emerson College in Boston and worked as a staff audiologist, or someone who helps treat hearing disorders. She was married to Colin Powell from 1961 until his death in October of 2021, standing by his side during his historic military career. 4 months after the Powells were married, Colin Powell was sent to Vietnam, leaving Alma to navigate the first few years of her life as a newlywed alone, something that she later called the defining experience of her life. She said that as a military spouse, your job was to make a home wherever you were. The Powell's three children, Michael, Linda, and Anne Marie, echoed those sentiments. They said of their mother, and I quote, "During childhoods marked by constant moving to new homes, we always felt secure because home was wherever she stood. She was an exemplary role model for us and for the world," end quote. Alma Johnson Powell was 86 years old. It's been a little over 2 weeks since the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump in Pennsylvania. He has now agreed to sit for a victim interview with the FBI about the incident. Victim interviews are a routine part of criminal investigations, but are voluntary. Kevin Rojek, the special agent in charge of the FBI's Pittsburgh field office, said the FBI wants to get Trump's perspective on what he observed, just like any other witness to the crime. FBI investigators continue to focus their efforts on uncovering the motive of Thomas Matthew Crooks, the 20-year-old would-be assassin. Rojek says what they do know is that Crooks had a growing interest in shooting. Before the Trump rally shooting, Crooks searched how far away Lee Harvey Oswald was from John F. Kennedy. He also made searches related to power plants, mass shooting events, information on improvised explosive devices, and the attempted assassination of the Slovakian prime minister earlier this year. To your local news, in New York City, Mayor Eric Adams declared a state of emergency over the weekend in city jails, issuing an executive order that blocked key parts of a local law that would have banned solitary confinement in the jails. The mayor's move came only 1 day before the law was set to go into effect. The emergency order, which took effect on Sunday, will remain in place until 30 days have passed or it has rescinded. According to the city's council website, the law would do a number of things, including 1. Limit the time a person can spend in solitary confinement to 4 hours, unless it falls under exceptional circumstances. And 2, limit restrictive housing to no more than 30 consecutive days and no more than 60 days within any 12-month period. Mayor Adams states in the order that the law would be dangerous and would subject incarcerated individuals and staff to further risk of harm. In the D.C. area, local leaders are saying that abnormally dry conditions across the D.C. area have given way to a drought watch affecting almost 6 million residents across the region. The Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments said in a news release that the Potomac River and backup reservoirs currently have an adequate water supply, but voluntary water conservation efforts will help complement measures already in place to mitigate water demand. As a result, residents and businesses are being asked to conserve their water use. Steps that can be taken include fixing plumbing leaks, washing full loads of dishes and clothes, and keeping showers to less than 5 minutes. More tips are available on the council's website, which is mwcog.org. Again, that's mwcog.org. In today's weather, it's currently about 82 degrees in New York and 91 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe, and thank you for listening.